Chapter 11. When Shasta went through the gate, he found a slope of grass and a little heather running up before him to some trees. He had nothing to think about now and no plans to make. He had only to run, and that was quite enough. His limbs were shaking, a terrible stitch was beginning in his side, and the sweat that kept dripping onto his eyes blinded them and made them smart. He was unsteady on his feet, too, and more than once nearly turned his ankle on the loose stone. The trees were thicker now than they had yet been, and in the more open spaces there was bracken. The sun had gone in without making it any cooler. It had become one of those hot gray days where there seemed to be twice as many flies as usual. Shasta's face was covered with them. He didn't even try to shake them off. He had too much else to do. Suddenly, he heard a horn. Not a great throbbing horn like the horns of Tashban, but the merry call, Triro Tututu. Next moment, he came out into a wide glade and found himself in a crowd of people. At least, it looked like a crowd of people. In reality, there were about 15 or 20 of them, all gentlemen in green hunting dress with their horses, some in the saddle, some standing by their horses' heads. In the center, someone was holding the stirrup for a man to mount. And the man he was holding it for was the jolliest, fat, apple-cheeked, twinkling-eyed king you could imagine. As soon as Shasta came in sight, this king forgot all about mounting his horse. He spread out his arms to Shasta, his face lit up, and he cried out in a great, deep voice that seemed to come from the bottom of his chest. "Corin, my son, and on foot and in rags! What?" "No," panted Shasta, shaking his head. "Not Prince Corin. I'm like him. I know I'm like him. Saw his highness and Tashban send his greetings." The king was staring at Shasta with an extraordinary expression on his face. "Are you King Loon?" Shasta gasped. And then, without waiting for an answer, "Lord King, fly, Anvard, shut the gates. Enemies upon you, Rashban and 200 horses." "Have you assurance of this boy?" asked one of the other gentlemen. "My own eyes," said Shasta. "I've seen them, raced them all the way from Tashban." "On foot?" said the gentleman, raising his eyebrows a little. "Horses with the hermit," said Shasta. "Question him no more, Darren," said the king alone. "I see truth in his face. We must ride for it, gentlemen. A spare horse there for the boy. You can ride fast, friend." For answer, Shasta put his foot in the stirrup of the horse, which had been led toward him, and a moment later he was in the saddle. He had done it 100 times with Bree in the last few weeks, and his mounting was very different now from what it had been the first night when Bree had said that he climbed up a horse as if he were climbing a haystack. He was pleased to hear the Lord Darren say to the king, "The boy has a true horseman's seat, sire. I'll warrant there's noble blood in him." "His blood, aye, there's the point," said the king, and he stared hard at Shasta again with that curious expression, almost a hungry one, in his steady gray eyes. But by now, the whole party was moving off in a brisk canter. Shasta's seat was excellent, but he was sadly puzzled with what to do with the reins, for he had never touched the reins while he was on Bree's back. But he looked very different out of the corner of his eyes to see what the others were doing, as some of us have probably done at parties when we weren't quite sure which knife or fork was we were meant to use. And he tried to get his fingers just right, but he didn't dare to try really directing the horse. He trusted it would follow the rest. The horse was, of course, an ordinary horse, not a talking one. But it had quite wits enough to realize that the strange boy on his back had no whip and no spurs, and was not really master of the situation. That was why Shasta soon found himself at the tail end of the procession. Even so, he was still going pretty fast. There were no flies now in the air, and his face was delicious. He had got his breath back, too, by this time, and now that his errand had succeeded. For the first time since the arrival at Tashban, how long ago that seemed, he was beginning to really enjoy himself. He looked up to see how much nearer the mountaintops had come. To his disappointment, he could not see them at all, only a vague grayness rolling down towards them. He had never been in mountain country before and was surprised. "It's a cloud," he said to himself. "A cloud coming down, I see. up here in the hills, one is really up in the sky. I shall see what the inside of a cloud is like. What fun! I've often wondered. Far away on his left, and a little behind him, the sun was getting ready to set. He had come to a rough kind of road by now, were making very good speed. But Shasta's horse was still the last of the lost. Once or twice, when the road made a bend, there was now continuous forest on each side of it. He lost sight of the others for a second or two. Then they plunged into the fog, or else the fog rolled over them. The world became gray. Shasta had not realized how cold and wet the inside of a cloud would be, nor how dark. The gray turned to black with alarming speed. Someone at the head of the column winded the horn every now and then, and each time the sound came a little farther off. He couldn't see any of the others now, but of course he'd be able to as soon as he got round the next bend. But when he rounded it, he still couldn't see them. In fact, he could see nothing at all. His horse was walking now. "Get on, horse, get on," said Shasta. Then came the horn, very, very faint. Bray had always told him that he must keep his heels well turned out, and Shasta had got the idea that something very terrible would happen if he dug his heels into a horse's side. This seemed to him an occasion for trying it out. "Look here, horse," he said. "If you don't buck up, do you know what I'll do? I'll dig my heels into you. I really will." The horse, however, took no notice of this threat. So Shasta settled himself firmly in the saddle, gripped with his knees, clenched his teeth, and punched both horse's sides with his heels as hard as he could. The only result was that the horse broke into a kind of pretense of a trot 5 or 6 paces, and then subsided into a walk again. Now it was quite dark, and they seemed to have given up blowing the horn. The only sound was a steady drip, drop, drip, drip, drip from the branches of the trees. "Well, I suppose even a walk will get us somewhere sometime," said Shasta to himself. "I only hope I shan't run into Rabadash and his people." He went on for what seemed like a long time, always at a walking pace. He began to hate that horse, and he was beginning to feel very hungry. Presently, he came to a place where the road divided into two. He was just wondering which led to Avangard when he was startled by a noise from behind him. It was the noise of trotting horses. "Rabadash," he thought to himself. He had no way of guessing which road Rabadash would take. "But if I take one," said Shasta to himself, "he may take the other, and if I stay at the crossroads, I'm sure to be caught." He dismounted and led his horse as quickly as he could along the right-hand road. The sound of the cavalry grew rapidly near, and in a minute or two, Shasta realized that they were at the crossroads. He held his breath, waiting to see which way they would take. There came a low word of command, "Halt!" Then a moment of horsey noise, his nostrils blowing, hoofs pawing, bits being clamped, necks being patted. Then the voice spoke. "Attend all of you," it said. "We are now within a furlong of the castle. Remember your orders. Once we are in Narnia, we should be by sunrise, you are to kill as little as possible. On this venture, you are to regard every drop of Narnian blood as more precious than a gallon of your own. On this venture, I say, the gods will send us a happier hour, and then you must leave nothing alive between Caer Paravel and the Western Waste. But we are not yet in Narnia. Here in Archerland, it is another thing. In the assault on this castle of King Loon's, nothing matters but speed. Show me your medal. It must be mine within an hour. And if it is, I give it all to you. I reserve no booty for myself. Kill me every barbarian male within its walls, down to the child that was born yesterday, and everything else is yours to divide as you please. The women, the gold, the jewels, the weapons, the wine, the men that I see hanging back when we come to the gates shall be burned alive. In the name of Tash, the irresistible, the inexorable, forward." With a great clippity-clop, the column began to move, and Shasta breathed again. They had taken the other road. Shasta thought they took a long time going past. Though he had been talking and thinking about 200 horses all day, he had not realized how many they really were. But at last the sound died away, and once more he was alone amid the drip-drip from the trees. He now knew the way to Unvard, but of course he could not now go there. That would only mean running into the arms of Rabadash's troopers. "What on earth am I to do?" said Shasta to himself. But he remembered his horse and continued along the road he had chosen, in the faint hope of finding some cottage where he might ask for shelter and a meal. He had thought, of course, of going back to Arvorus and Brienne Huynh at the Hermitage, but he couldn't because by now he had not the least idea of the direction. After all, said Shasta, this road is bound to get somewhere. But that all depends on what you mean by somewhere. The road kept on getting to somewhere, in the sense that it got to more and more trees, all dark and dripping into colder and colder air. And strange icy winds kept blowing the mist past him, though they never blew it away. If he had been used to mountain country, he would have realized that this meant he was now up very high, perhaps right at the top of the pass, but Shasta knew nothing about mountains. I do think, said Shasta, that I must be the most unfortunate boy that ever lived in the whole world. Everything goes right for everyone except me. Those Narnian lords and ladies got safe away from Tashban. I was left behind. Arvorus and Brienne Huynh are all as snug as anything with that old hermit. Of course, I was the one who was sent on. King Loon and his people must have gotten safely to the castle and shut the gates long before Rabadesh arrived. But I got left out. And being very tired and having nothing inside him, he felt so sorry for himself that the tears rolled down his cheeks. What put a stop to all this was a sudden fright. Shasta discovered that someone or somebody was walking beside him. It was pitch dark, and he could see nothing, and the thing or person was going so quietly that he could hardly hear any footfalls. What he could hear was breathing. His invisible companion seemed to breathe on a very large scale, and Shasta got the impression that it was a very large creature. And he had come to notice this breathing so gradually that he had really no idea how long it had been there. It was a horrible shock. It darted into his mind that he had heard long ago that there were giants in these northern countries. He bit his lip in terror. But now that he really had something to cry about, he stopped crying. The thing, unless it was a person, went home beside him so very quietly that Shasta began to hope he had only imagined it. But just as he was becoming quite sure of it, there suddenly became a deep, rich sigh out of the darkness beside him. That couldn't be imagination. Anyway, he had felt the hot breath of that sigh on his chilly left hand. If the horse had been any good, or if he had known how to get any good out of the horse, he would have risked everything on a breakaway in a wild gallop. But he knew he couldn't make that horse gallop. So he went on at a walking pace, and the unseen companion walked and breathed beside him. At last he could bear it no longer. "Who are you?" he said, scarcely above a whisper. "One who has waited long for you to speak," said the thing. Its voice was not loud, but very large and deep. "Are you a giant?" asked Shasta. "You might call me a giant," said the large voice, "but I am not like the creatures you call giants." "I can't see you at all," said Shasta after staring very hard. Then, for an even more terrible idea had come into his head, he said, almost in a scream, you're not something dead, are you? Oh, please, please do go away. What harm have I ever done you? Oh, I am the unluckiest person in the whole world. Once more, he felt the warm breath of the thing on his hand and face. There, it said, that is not the breath of a ghost. Tell me your sorrows. Shasta was a little reassured by the breath, so he told how he had never known his real father or his mother, and how he had been brought up sternly by the fishermen. And then he told the story of his escape, and how he was chased by lions, forced to swim for their lives, all of their other dangers in Tashban, and past night among the tombs, how the beasts that howled at him out of the desert. Then he told about the heat and the thirst of their journey, and how they were almost at their goal when another lion chased them, wounded Arvorus. Also, how very long it was since he had had anything to eat. "I do not call you unfortunate," said the large voice. "Don't you think it was bad luck to meet so many lions?" said Shasta. "There was only one lion," said the voice. "What on earth do you mean? I've just told you that there were at least two the first night, and there was only one, but he was swift of foot." "How do you know?" "I was the lion." And the Shasta gaped with open mouth and said nothing. The voice continued. "I was the lion who forced you to join with Arvorus. I was the cat who comforted you among the houses of the dead. I was the lion who drove the jackals from you while you slept. I was the lion who gave the horses the new strength and fear for the last mile, so that you could reach King Loon in time. I was the lion you do not remember who pushed the boat in which you lay, a child near death, so that you came to shore where a man sat, wakeful at night, to receive you. Then it was you who wounded Arvorous? That was I. But why? For what? Child, said the voice, I am telling you your story, not hers. I tell no one any story but their own. Who are you? Shasta asked. Myself, said the voice, very deep and low, that the earth shook, and again, myself, loud and clear and gay, and then the third time, myself, whispered so softly you could hardly hear it, and yet it seemed to come from all around you as if the leaves rustled with it. Shasta was no longer afraid that the voice belonged to something that would eat him, nor that it was the voice of a ghost, but a new and different sort of trembling came over him, yet he felt glad too. The mist was turning from black to gray, and from gray to white. This must have begun to happen some time ago, but while he had been talking with the thing, he had not been noticing anything else. Now the whiteness around him became a shining whiteness. He had to blink his eyes. Somewhere ahead, he could hear birds singing. He knew the night was almost over. He could see the mane and ears and the head of the horse quite easily now. A golden light fell on them from the left. He thought it was the sun. He turned and saw, pacing beside him, taller than the horse, was a lion. The horse did not seem to be afraid of it, or else chose not to see it. It was from the lion that the light came. No one ever saw anything more terrible or beautiful. Luckily, Shasta had lived all his life too far south in Kalmarn to have heard the tales that were whispered in Tashban about a dreadful Narnian demon that appeared in the form of a lion. And, of course, he knew none of the true stories about Aslan, the great lion, the son of the Emperor over the sea, the king above all high kings in Narnia. But after one glance at the lion's face, he slipped out of the saddle and fell to at its feet. He couldn't say anything, but then he didn't know what to say, and he knew he needn't say anything. The High King above all kings stepped toward him, its mane and some strange and solemn perfume that hung about it was all around him. It touched his forehead with its tongue. He lifted its face, and their eyes met. Then instantly the pale brightness of the mist and the fiery brightness of the lion rolled themselves together into a swirling glory, and gathered themselves up and disappeared. He was alone with the horse on a grassy hillside under a blue sky, and there were birds singing. Chapter 12. It was all a dream, wondered Shasta, but it couldn't have been a dream, for there were in the grass before him he saw the deep, large prints of the lion's front paw. It took one's breath away to think of the weight that could have made a footprint like that, but there was something more remarkable about the size of it. As he looked at it, water had already filled the bottom. Soon it was full to the brim, and then overflowing, and a little stream was running downhill past him over the grass. Shasta stooped and drank. It was a very long drink. And then dipped his face in and splashed his head. It was extremely cold and as clear as glass, and it refreshed him very much. After that, he stood up, shaking the water out of his ears and flinging the wet hair back from his forehead, and began to take stock of his surroundings. Apparently, it was still very early morning. The sun had only just risen, and it had risen out of the forest, which he saw low down and far away on his right. The country which he was looking at was absolutely new to him. It was a green valley, land dotted with trees through which he caught the gleam of a river that wound away roughly to the northwest. On the far side of the valley, there were high and even rocky hills, but they were much lower than the mountains he had seen yesterday. Then he began to guess where he was. He turned and looked behind him and saw that the slope on which he was standing belonged to a range of far higher mountains. I see, said Shasta to himself. Those are the big mountains between Archenland and Narnia. I was on the other side of them yesterday. I must have come through the pass in the night. What luck that I hid it. At least it wasn't luck all at all, really. It was him. And now I'm in Narnia. He turned and unsaddled his horse and took off its bridle. Though you are a perfectly horrid horse, he said. He took no notice of this remark and immediately began eating grass. That horse had a very low opinion of Shasta as well. I wish I could eat grass, thought Shasta. It's no good going back to Andvard. It'll all be besieged. I better get lower down to the valley and see if I can get anything to eat. So he went on downhill. The thick dew was cruelly cold on his bare feet, till he came into a wood. There was a kind of track running through it, and he had not followed this for many minutes when he heard a thick and rather wheezy voice saying to him, "Good morning, neighbor." Shasta looked round eagerly to find the speaker, and presently saw a small, prickly person with a dark face who had just come out from among the trees. At least, it was small for a person, but very big for a hedgehog, which was what it was. "Good morning," said Shasta, "but I'm not a neighbor. In fact, I'm a stranger in these parts." "Ah?" said the hedgehog inquiringly. "I've come over the mountains, from Archenland, you know." "Ah, Archenland," said the hedgehog. "That's a terrible long way. Never been there myself." "And I think, perhaps," said Shasta, "someone ought to be told that there's an army of savage Calmarans attacking Andvard at this very moment." "You don't say," answered the hedgehog. "Well, think of that. And they do say that Calmaran is hundreds of thousands of miles away, right on the world's end, across the great sea of sand." "It's not nearly as far as you think," said Shasta. "And oughtn't something be done about this attack on Andvard? Oughtn't your High King be told?" "Certain, sure, something ought to be done about it," said the hedgehog. "But you see, I'm just on my way to bed for a good day's sleep. Hello, neighbor." The last words were addressed to an immense biscuit-colored rabbit whose head had just popped up from somewhere beside the path. The hedgehog immediately told the rabbit what he had just learned from Shasta. The rabbit agreed that this was very remarkable news and that somebody ought to be told. And that person has to be able to do something. And so it went on. Every few minutes they were joined by other creatures, some from the branches overhead, some from little underground houses at their feet, till the party consisted of 5 rabbits, a squirrel, 2 magpies, a goat-footed fawn, and a mouse, who all talked at the same time and all agreed with the hedgehog. For the truth was that in that golden age when the witch and the winter had gone and Peter the High King ruled in Caer Paravel, the smaller woodland people of Narnia were so safe and happy that they were getting a little careless. Presently, however, 2 more practical people arrived in the little wood. One was a red dwarf, whose name appeared to be Duffel. The other was a stag, a beautiful lordly creature with white liquid eyes, dappled flanks and legs so thin and graceful that they looked as if you could break them with 2 fingers. "Lion alive!" roared the dwarf as soon as he had heard the news. "And if that's so, why are we all standing still chattering? Enemies at Andvard? News must be sent to Caer Paravel at once. The army must be called out. Narnia must go to the aid of King Loon." "Ah," said the hedgehog, "but you won't find the High King in Caer. He's away to the north, trouncing those giants. And talking of giants, neighbors, that puts me in mind..." "Who'll take our message?" interrupted the dwarf. "Anyone here got more speed than me?" "I've got speed," said the stag. "What's my message? How many Calmarans?" 200, under Prince Rabidash, and..." But the stag was already away, all 4 legs off the ground at once, and in a moment its white stern had disappeared among the remoter trees. "Wonder where he's going," said the rabbit. "He won't find the king, High King at Caer Paravel, you know." "He'll go find Queen Lucy," said Duffel. "And then, hello, what's wrong with the human? It looks pretty green. Why, I do believe it's quite faint. Perhaps it's mortal hungry. And when did you have a meal last, youngster?" "Yesterday morning," said Shasta weakly. "Come on, then, come on," said the dwarf, at once throwing his thick little arms around Shasta's waist to support him. "Why, neighbors, we ought to all be ashamed of ourselves. You come with me, lad, breakfast. Better than talking." With a great deal of bustle, muttering reproaches to itself, the dwarf half led, half supported, Shasta at a great speed further into the wood and a little downhill. It was a longer walk than Shasta wanted at that moment, and his legs had begun to feel very shaky before they came out from the trees onto a bare hillside. There they found a little house with a smoking chimney and an open door, and as they came to the doorway, Duffel called out, "Hey, brothers, a visitor for breakfast." Immediately, mixed with a sizzling sound, there came to Shasta a simply delightful smell. It was one he had never smelled before in his life, but I hope you have. It was, in fact, the smell of bacon and eggs and mushrooms, all frying in a pan. "Mind your head, lad," said Duffel, a moment too late, for Shasta had already bashed his forehead against the low lintel of the doorway. "Now," continued the dwarf, "sit you down. The table's a bit low for you, but then the stool's too low, too." "That's right. And here's porridge and a jug of cream, and there's a spoon." By the time Shasta had finished the porridge, the dwarf's two brothers, whose names were Rogan and Bricket Thumb, were pushing the dish of bacon and eggs and mushrooms and the coffee pot and the hot milk and the toast on the table. It was all new and wonderful to Shasta, for Kalmarin food was quite different. He didn't even know what the slices of brown stuff were, for he had never seen toast before. He didn't know what the yellow soft thing they smeared on the toast was either, because in Kalmarin you nearly always get oil instead of butter. The house itself was quite different from the dark, frowsy smell, fish-smelling hut of Arsheesh, and from the pillared and carpeted halls of the palaces in Tashban. The roof was very low, and everything was made of wood. There was a cuckoo clock and a red and white checked tablecloth, a bowl of wild flowers, little curtains on the thick paned windows. It was also rather troublesome having to use dwarfs' cups, plates, knives, and forks. This meant that helpings were very small, but then there were a great many helpings, so that Shasta's plate or cup was being filled every moment, and every moment the dwarfs themselves were saying, "Butter, please, or another cup of coffee, or I'd like a few more mushrooms, or what about frying another egg or so?" And when at last they had all eaten as much as they possibly could, three dwarves drew lots for who was going to do the washing, and Rogan was the unlucky one. Then Duffel and Brittle Thumb took Shasta outside to a bench which ran along the outside of the cottage wall. And they all stretched out their legs and gave a great sigh of contentment, and the two dwarves lit their pipes. The dew was off the grass now, and the sun was warm. Indeed, if there hadn't been a light breeze, it would have been too hot. "Now, stranger," said Duffel, "I'll show you the lay of the land. You can see nearly all South Narnia from here, and we're rather proud of this view. Right away on your left, behind those near hills, you can just see the Western Mountains. And that round hill way off your right is called the Hill of the Stone Table, just beyond." But at that moment, he was interrupted by a snore from Shasta, who, with his night's journey and his excellent breakfast, had gone fast asleep. The kindly dwarves, as soon as they noticed this, began making signs to each other not to wake him. And then they did so much whispering and nodding and getting up and tiptoeing away, that they certainly would have waked him if he had been less tired. He slept pretty well nearly all day, but woke up in time for supper. The beds in that house were all too small for him, but they made him a fine bed of heather on the floor, and he never stirred or dreamed all night. Next morning, they had just finished breakfast when they heard a shrill, exciting sound from outside. "Trumpets!" said all the dwarves, as they and Shasta all came running out. The trumpets sounded again, a new noise for Shasta, not huge and solemn like the horns of Tashban, or gay and merry like King Loon's hunting horn. Horn, but clear, sharp, and vibrant. The noise was coming from the woods to the east, and soon there was the noise of horse hooves mixed with it. A moment later, the head of the column came into sight. First came the Lord Paradin on a bay horse, carrying the great banner of Narnia, a red lion on a green ground. Shasta knew him at once. Then came three people riding abreast, two on great chargers and one on a pony. The two on the great chargers were King Edmund and a fair-haired lady with a very merry face who wore a helmet and a mail shirt, and carried a bow across her shoulder and a quiver full of arrows on her side. "Queen Lucy," whispered Duffel. But the one on the pony was Corin. After that came the main body of the army. Men on ordinary horses, men on talking horses who didn't mind being ridden on proper occasions, as when Narnia went to war. Centaurs, stern, hard-bitten bears, talking great dogs, and at last, of all, six giants. For there were good giants in Narnia, but though he knew they were on the right side, Shasta at first could hardly bear to look at them. There were some things that take a lot of getting used to. Just as the king and queen reached the cottage, and the dwarves began making low bows to them, King Edmund called out, "Now, friends, time for a halt and a morsel." And at once there was a great bustle of people dismounting and haversacks being opened and conversation beginning when Corin came running up to Shasta and seized both hands in his hands and cried, "What? You here? So you got through all right. I am glad. Now we shall have some sport. And isn't it luck? We only got to the harbor at Caraparval yesterday morning, and the very first person who met us was Sir Fred the Stag with this news of an attack on Anvard. Don't you think?" "Who is your highness's friend?" asked King Edmund, who had just got off his horse. "Don't you see, sire?" said Corin. "It's my double, the boy you mistook for me in Tashban." "Why, so he is your double," exclaimed Queen Lucy, as two twins. "This is a marvelous thing." "Please, your majesty," said Shasta to King Edmund. "I was no traitor, really, I wasn't, and I couldn't help hearing your plans, but I never have dreamed of telling them to your enemies." "I know now that you are no traitor, boy," said King Edmund, laying his hand on Shasta's head. "But if you would not be taken for one, another time try not to hear what's meant for other ears. But all's well." After that, there was so much bustle and talking and coming and going that Shasta, for a few minutes, lost sight of Corin and Edmund and Lucy. For Corin was the sort of boy whom one is sure to hear of pretty soon. And it wasn't long, very long, before Shasta heard King Edmund saying in a loud voice, "By the lion's mane, prince, this is too much. Will your highness never be better? You are more of a heart scald than our whole army together. I'd as lief have a regiment of hornets at my command as you." Shasta wormed his way through the crowd and there saw Edmund looking very angry indeed. Corin looking a little ashamed of himself, and a strange dwarf sitting on the ground making faces. A couple of fawns had apparently just been helping it out of its armor. "If I had but my cordial with me," said Lucy, "I could mend this, but the High King has so strictly charged me not to carry it commonly to the wars and to keep it only for great extremities." What had happened was this. As soon as Corin had spoken to Shasta, Corin's elbow had been plucked by a dwarf in the army called Thornbutt. "What is it, Thornbutt?" Corin had said. "Your Royal Highness," he said, drawing him aside, "our march today will bring us through the pass and right to your royal father's castle. We may be in battle before night." "I know," said Corin. "Isn't it splendid?" "Splendid or not," said Thornbutt, "but I have the strictest orders from King Edmund to see that to it that your highness is not in the fight. You will be allowed to see it, and that's treat enough for your highness's little ears." "Oh, what nonsense," Corin burst out. "Of course I'm going to fight. Why, the Queen's Lucy's going to be with the archers." "The Queen's Grace will do as she pleases," said Thornbutt, "but you are in my charge. Either I must have your solemn and princely word that you'll keep your pony beside mine, not half a neck ahead, till I give your highness leave to depart, or else it is his majesty's word. We must go with our wrists tied together like two prisoners. "I'll knock you down if you try to bind me," said Corin. "I'd like to see your highness do it," said the dwarf. That was quite enough for a boy like Corin, and in a second he and the dwarf were at it hammer and tongs. It would have been an even match, for Corin had longer arms and more height, but the dwarf was older and tougher. It was never fought out. That's the worst of fights on a rough hillside. For by very bad luck, Thornbutt trod on a loose stone, came flat down on his nose, and found that when he tried to get up, he had sprained his ankle. A real excruciating sprain, which would keep him from walking or riding for at least a fortnight or 2 weeks. "See what your highness has done," said King Edmund. "Deprived us of a proved warrior on the very edge of battle. "I'll take his place, sires of Corn," said Edmund. "No one doubts your courage, but a boy in battle is a danger only to his own side." At that moment, the king was called away to attend to something else, and Corn, after apologizing handsomely to the dwarf, rushed up the Shasta and whispered, "Quick, there's a spare pony now, and the dwarf's armor. Put it on before anyone notices." "What for?" asked Shasta. "Why, so that you and I can fight in the battle, of course. Don't you want to?"
Yeah, of course," said Shasta.
But he hadn't been thinking of doing so at all, beginning to get a most uncomfortable prickly feeling in his spine.
"That's right," said Corn, "over your head, now the sword belt. But we must ride near the tail of the column and keep as quiet as mice. Once the battle begins, everyone will be far too busy to notice us."